The Sacred Architecture of a Day. A single speaker podcast, 60 minutes exploring the Trikal Sandhya through Advaita, Bhakti, Jesus, Buddha, and the Stoics. Cold open. There's a phrase in Sanskrit, Trikal Sandhya. Tri means three, Kal means time, Sandhya means junction, literally the joining point, the twilight zone between one state and another. Three times a day, at the junctions of waking, eating, and sleeping, the ancient tradition prescribes a set of prayers. Not prayers in the way most of us think of prayer. Not petitions to a distant god, not wish lists, not guilt-laden recitations. These are something else entirely. They are technologies of remembrance. They are designed to interrupt the trance of autopilot living and return you, three times a day, every day, to the question that every great wisdom tradition has placed at the center of human life. What is the ground of your being? And are you living from it? Today I want to take you inside these prayers, line by line, word by word. Not as a Hindu exercise, though they come from that tradition, but as a universal contemplative practice that, once you see what's actually being said, reveals itself to be in profound conversation with Advaita Vedanta, with the Bhakti tradition, with the teachings of Jesus, with the insights of the Buddha, and with Stoic philosophy. Because here's what I've come to understand. The great traditions are not saying different things, they are saying the same thing in different languages, from different angles, for different temperaments. And these small daily prayers, these seemingly simple verses that millions of people recite every morning and evening, contain, in compressed form, the entire architecture of the spiritual life. So, let's begin where the day begins. Segment 1, The Dawn, Prayers Upon Awakening. Approximate runtime, 12 minutes. The first prayer in the Trikal Sandhya is said the moment you wake up. Before you check your phone, before your feet touch the ground, before the world rushes in, you look at your hands and you say, Karagre Vasate Lakshmi, Karamule Saraswati, Karamadye Tu Govinda, Prabhate Karadarshanam. Here's what it means. At the tips of my fingers dwells Lakshmi, the goddess of abundance, of prosperity, of the creative power that manifests in the world. At the base of my palms dwells Saraswati, the goddess of wisdom, of knowledge, of the deep intelligence that underlies all things. And in the center of my hands dwells Govinda, the Lord, the Sustainer, the Divine itself. Therefore, in the morning, I gaze upon my hands. Now, on the surface, this is a beautiful devotional gesture. You wake up, you look at your hands, you remember that the sacred lives in you. Lovely. But go deeper. What is actually happening here? You are being asked, in the first conscious moment of your day, to recognize that your hands, your instruments of action in the world, contain three things simultaneously: the power to create wealth and abundance, the power to generate wisdom and understanding, and the presence of the divine itself. These are not three separate things living in three separate zones of your palm. The prayer maps them onto the hand to make a point. They are one integrated reality. Abundance, wisdom, and God are not in competition. They are not separate departments of life. They are three expressions of the same source, and that source is literally in your hands. This is Advaita Vedanta in compressed, devotional form. Shankara would recognize this immediately. The whole point of Advaita, non-duality, is that Brahman, the absolute reality, is not somewhere else. It is not up in heaven, waiting for you to earn access. It is the very substance of everything, including your body, your hands, your capacity to act. The Mandukya Upanishad says it in four syllables. I am Atma Brahma. This self is Brahman. Not will become Brahman, not is part of Brahman, is Brahman. So, when you look at your hands and see Lakshmi, Saraswati, and Govinda, what you are really seeing from the Advaitic perspective is that every dimension of your lived experience is already Brahman. Your work is Brahman. Your knowledge is Brahman. Your being is Brahman. There is nothing in your hands, nothing in your life that is outside the divine. Now here's where this gets interesting for those of us who also sit with the teachings of Jesus. In the Gospel of Thomas, one of the Gnostic Gospels, not included in the canonical Bible, but widely regarded as containing authentic sayings of Jesus, there is a remarkable verse. Jesus says, "Split a piece of wood, I am there. Lift up a stone, and you will find me there. Split a piece of wood, I am there." That is not the language of a God who lives in a temple or a heaven. That is the language of radical immanence. That is a teacher telling you that the kingdom is not coming in the future. It is not earned through good behavior. It is here. It is in the wood, in the stone, in the mundane material of daily life. And what does the Trikal Sandhya say? Kara Madhye Tu Govinda, in the middle of your hand, in the most ordinary, practical, everyday part of your body, dwells the Lord. Same teaching, different language. The Buddha approached this from another angle entirely, and it's worth pausing here because the Buddhist parallel is subtle and important. The Buddha would not have spoken about Lakshmi or Govinda dwelling in your hands. He was famously agnostic about metaphysical questions, not because he denied the sacred, but because he understood that clinging to concepts about the sacred can become its own form of bondage. But here's what he would have said, and what I think he did say in essence. When you wake up, you have a choice. You can wake up lost in the dream, immediately seized by craving, by aversion, by the momentum of yesterday's unfinished business. Or you can wake up aware that you are waking up. You can catch the moment of transition. You can be present for the dawn. This is what the Trikal Sandhya is engineering. The word Sandhya, junction, twilight, refers to the gaps between states. The transition from sleep to waking is a gap. And in Buddhist practice, the gaps are where freedom lives. The space between stimulus and response. The pause between thoughts. The moment before the habit pattern kicks in. By prescribing a prayer at the exact moment of waking, the tradition is saying, catch the gap. Don't let the first moment of consciousness be hijacked by your phone, your anxiety, your to-do list. Reclaim that moment. Consecrate it. And the Stoics? Marcus Aurelius did this every single morning. He wrote in the Meditations, which remember, was never meant to be published. It was his private journal. He wrote, "Think of what a precious privilege it is to be alive, to breathe, to think, to enjoy, to love." He also wrote something harder. Say to yourself first thing in the morning, "Today I will meet with interference, ingratitude, insolence, disloyalty, ill will, and selfishness, all of them due to the offender's ignorance of what is good and what is evil." This is not pessimism. This is morning prayer, Stoic style. Marcus was doing what the Trikal Sandhya does, using the first moments of the day to establish a ground, to set a foundation before the storms come. The Hindu prayer says, "Look at your hands and see the divine." Marcus says, "Look at the day ahead and remember your nature." The content differs, the function is identical. Both are technologies for ensuring that your first conscious act is an act of remembrance, of who you are, of what is real, of what cannot be taken from you. And I want to linger on one more thing about this morning prayer before we move on. The prayer says Prabhate Kara Darshanam. In the morning, I gaze upon my hands. The word Darshanam is important. It doesn't just mean looking, it means sacred seeing. It's the same word used for the experience of beholding a deity in a temple. Darshan. You are not casually glancing at your hands. You are beholding them the way a devotee beholds the divine. You are looking at your own body, your own instrument of action, and seeing it as sacred. This is where bhakti and advaita meet. In pure advaita, there's a risk of the teaching becoming too abstract. Everything is Brahman can become an intellectual position rather than a lived reality. Bhakti brings it home. Bhakti says, "Don't just know that the divine is everywhere. Feel it. See it. Let your heart crack open at the recognition. Let the seeing itself become an act of devotion." And that is what this prayer invites you to do before your feet ever touch the floor. Segment 2, The Ground, Prayers Before Stepping on Earth. Approximate runtime, 14 minutes. Now your feet are about to touch the ground, and the tradition says, wait, before you step on the earth, pray to her, ask for forgiveness. Samudra Vasane Devi, Parvatastana Mandale, Vishnu Patni Namastubhyam, Pada Sparshan Kshamasvame. O goddess who wears the oceans as her garment, whose breasts are the mountains, consort of Vishnu, I bow to you. Forgive me for touching you with my feet. Read that again slowly. The earth is not dirt beneath you. She is a goddess. The oceans are her clothing. The mountains are her body. She is the consort of the sustainer of the universe. And you, you small mortal creature, are about to step on her. So you ask, forgive me. This is not guilt. This is awe. There is a massive difference between guilt-based religion and awe-based spirituality, and the Trikal Sandhya operates entirely in the territory of awe. You are not apologizing because you are sinful. You are apologizing because the ground beneath your feet is holy, and you know it, and you want to walk on it with the reverence it deserves. Jesus said something that maps directly onto this. In Exodus, which Jesus would have known intimately, God speaks to Moses from the burning bush and says, take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. Holy ground. Not holy heaven, not holy temple. The ground. The dirt. The actual earth beneath your actual feet. And what does the Trikal Sandhya say? The earth herself is a goddess. Every piece of ground you step on is holy ground. And the appropriate response to standing on holy ground is not entitlement, it is humility. Now, the Buddhist tradition has something very particular to say about this that I think is essential. In the Metta Sutta, the Buddha's discourse on loving kindness, there is a famous image. The Buddha says that just as a mother would protect her only child with her life, so should one cultivate a boundless heart toward all beings. All beings, not just humans, not just sentient creatures. The Buddhist understanding of interdependence, pratityasamutpada, dependent origination, means that you are not separate from the earth. You are not a tenant living on a piece of property. You are the earth, temporarily organized into a human form, walking on yourself. The prayer asks the earth for forgiveness. The Buddhist insight tells you why that request makes sense. Because the boundary between you and the earth is a useful fiction. You eat the earth, it becomes your body. Your body dies, it becomes the earth again. Asking the earth for forgiveness is not addressing a stranger. It is recognizing your deepest intimacy with the ground of your physical existence. The Stoics would have understood this through the concept of sympatheia, the idea that everything in the cosmos is connected, that the universe is a single living organism. Marcus Aurelius, constantly think of the universe as one living creature, embracing one being and one soul. Epictetus, you are not a fragment of the universe, you are the universe in miniature. When the Stoic walks on the ground, he walks on his own larger body. When the Hindu devotee asks the earth for forgiveness, she is not performing a quaint ritual. She is re-establishing a felt relationship with the physical world that modern life has almost completely destroyed. Think about this. How many of us step out of bed onto manufactured carpet, walk on manufactured tile, drive on manufactured asphalt, sit on manufactured chairs in manufactured buildings, and never once feel the earth? We have literally insulated ourselves from the ground. We have put layers and layers of material between our skin and the planet that sustains us. This prayer says, before you do any of that, stop. Touch the ground with awareness. Know what you are touching. Know who you are touching. And then, immediately after addressing the earth, the tradition pivots. You pray to Krishna. Vasudeva Sutam Devam, Kansa Chanura Mardanam, Devaki Padamanandam, Krishnam Vande Jagadgurum. I worship Krishna, son of Vasudeva, destroyer of Kansa and Chanura, supreme joy of Devaki, teacher of the world. Now why does the prayer shift here? You've just bowed to the earth, to the immanent, the material, the ground, and now you're invoking Krishna, the transcendent teacher, the Jagadguru, the guru of the entire world. This is the full non-dual move. You don't worship only the earth. You don't worship only the transcendent. You hold both. The immanent and the transcendent. The ground and the sky. The goddess beneath you and the Lord above and within you. This is the Bhagavad Gita's central teaching in two prayers. The divine is both here, in the mud, in the matter, in the earth, and beyond, in the unmanifest, the absolute, the teacher of all teachers. Krishna is called Jagadguru, world teacher, not Hindu teacher, not Indian teacher, world teacher. The tradition itself is claiming universality for this teaching. And when you look at who the world's great teachers actually were, Krishna, Buddha, Jesus, Lao Tzu, Socrates, they all pointed to the same ground. They all said, wake up, see what is, stop living in the dream. The specific title Kansa Chanura Mardanam, destroyer of Kansa and Chanura, is not just a historical reference to Krishna's defeat of the tyrant Kansa. It is a metaphor for what the divine does within you. Kansa represents tyranny, the tyrannical ego that imprisons the soul. Chanura represents brute force, the blunt violence of unconscious reactivity. Krishna destroys both, not through gentleness alone, but through power. This is the warrior dimension of the spiritual life. Jesus overturned the tables in the temple. The Buddha confronted Mara directly and said, I see you. Marcus Aurelius led armies while writing about the nature of the soul. The spiritual life is not passive. The morning prayer invokes a God who fights, who destroys tyranny, who liberates the imprisoned. And then the prayer calls Krishna Devaki Padmanandam, the supreme bliss of his mother Devaki. After all the cosmic theology, after the warrior imagery, we get tenderness, a mother's joy in her child. This is bhakti's genius. It refuses to let the divine remain abstract. God is not just the absolute. God is also a baby who makes his mother weep with happiness. This oscillation between the cosmic and the intimate, between the philosophical and the devotional, is the heartbeat of the Trikal Sandhya, and it is, I would argue, the heartbeat of mature spirituality everywhere. Segment 3. The Fire. Prayers Before Eating. Approximate runtime, 18 minutes. This is the longest section of the Trikal Sandhya, and it is the deepest. The prayers before eating are drawn directly from the Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishads, and they contain, in my view, some of the most radical spiritual statements ever made in any language. Let's start with the opening verse. Yagna shista shina santo, muchyante sarva kilbishaihi, bunjate te tvagham papa, ye pachantyatma karanat. The righteous who eat the remnants of sacrifice are freed from all sins. But those who cook food only for themselves, they eat sin. Now I know, the word sin triggers a lot of people, especially those of us who have been wounded by guilt-based religious frameworks. So let me reframe this in a way that I think is truer to what the verse is actually saying. The word used in the Gita is kilbisha, which means impurity, obstacle, that which obscures. It's closer to the Buddhist concept of kilesa, defilement, mental obstruction, than to the Christian concept of original sin. The verse is not saying you are a sinner who needs to be saved. It is saying that when you eat food as an act of sacred offering, as yagna, as sacrifice, you are freed from the mental obstructions that cloud your consciousness. But when you eat food as a purely self-serving act, cooking only for your own pleasure, consuming only for your own body, you are feeding the ego structure rather than dissolving it. This is an extraordinary claim. It means that how you eat changes what eating does to your consciousness. The same physical act, putting food in your mouth, has completely different spiritual consequences depending on the intention behind it. Eat with awareness and gratitude and the recognition that this food is a gift from the earth, from other beings, from the sun, from rain, from countless hands, and the act of eating becomes purifying. Eat unconsciously, greedily, only for yourself, and the act of eating reinforces the prison of the separate self. The Buddha would have agreed completely. The Buddhist tradition places enormous emphasis on mindful eating. In the Zen tradition, there's a meal chant that begins, "Innumerable labors brought us this food. We should know how it comes to us." Before eating, the monk reflects on whether they are worthy of the food, on all the beings who made it possible, and on the purpose of eating, which is not pleasure, but the sustenance of practice. Jesus made the same move, but he went even further. At the Last Supper, he took bread and said, "This is my body." He took wine and said, "This is my blood." Whatever you believe about the theology of the Eucharist, look at what is happening on the level of spiritual technology. Jesus is transforming the act of eating from a biological function into a sacrament. He is saying, when you eat with full consciousness, with full presence, with full recognition of what is being given, you are not eating bread. You are eating the body of God. And that is exactly what the next verse of the Trikal Sandhya says. Listen to this. Brahmarpanam brahmahavihi, brahmagnal brahmanahutam, brahmaiva tena gantavyam, brahma karma samadina. This is Bhagavad Gita, chapter 4, verse 24. And it is, in my opinion, one of the most important verses in all of world scripture. Here is what it says. The act of offering is Brahman. The offering itself is Brahman. The fire into which the offering is made is Brahman. The one who offers is Brahman. The destination reached by the one who is absorbed in this awareness is Brahman alone. Read that again. The act of offering, Brahman. The thing being offered, Brahman. The fire that receives the offering, Brahman. The person making the offering, Brahman. The result of the offering, Brahman. There is nothing in this equation that is not Brahman. This is the purest expression of Advaita Vedanta you will find anywhere. There is no duality here. There is no separation between the sacred and the profane, between the worshipper and the worshipped, between the act and the actor, between the gift and the giver. Everything, everything is one undivided reality, and you are reciting this before lunch. Think about the audacity of that. You are sitting down to eat a meal, a completely ordinary, daily, mundane act. And the tradition hands you a verse that says, this meal is the absolute. Your hunger is the absolute. The food is the absolute. Your body is the absolute. The fire of digestion is the absolute. There is nothing happening here that is not God. If you take this seriously, and I mean seriously, not as a nice philosophical idea, but as a lived, felt, embodied truth, it changes everything about how you eat. It changes everything about how you live. Because if Brahman is the offering, and the fire, and the one who offers, then Brahman is also your morning commute, and your difficult conversation, and your tax return, and your grief, and your boredom, and your ecstasy. There is nowhere you can go where Brahman is not. The Stoics had a parallel concept they called Logos, the rational, divine ordering principle that pervades all of reality. For the Stoics, you could not step outside the Logos. You could be ignorant of it, you could resist it, you could live in contradiction to it, but you could never actually leave it, because it is reality. Epictetus taught that recognizing this, truly recognizing that you are a part of the whole, that the whole expresses itself through you, is the beginning of freedom. The Brahman verse takes this further. The Stoic says, you are part of the Logos. The Advaitin says, you are Brahman. Not a part, not an expression, not a fragment. The whole thing, all of it. Tat Tvamasi, thou art that. Now immediately after this cosmic declaration, the Trikal Sandhya brings it back to the personal. The next verse, Yat Karoshi Yajnasi, Yad Juhoshi Dadasi Yat Tapasyasi Kaunteya, Tat Kuroshvamadarpanam. Whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer in sacrifice, whatever you give, whatever austerities you practice, do it as an offering to me. This is Bhagavad Gita 9:27, and it's Krishna speaking directly to Arjuna. And the shift here is crucial. The previous verse was Advaita, pure non-duality, no separation, everything is Brahman. This verse is Bhakti, devotion, relationship, offering. Do it as an offering to me. Not recognize that it is already Brahman, but offer it to me. There is a you, and there is a me. There is a devotee, and there is a Lord. there is a relationship. This is the great tension at the heart of Indian spirituality, the tension between Advaita and Bhakti, between non-duality and devotion. Shankara said, there is only Brahman. Ramanuja said there is Brahman and the soul in relationship. Madhva said they are eternally distinct. The Trikal Sandhya does not resolve this tension. It holds it. It places the Advaita verse and the Bhakti verse side by side, as if to say, both are true. At the highest level, there is only Brahman. At the level of lived experience, you are a devotee offering your life to the divine. Both are real. Both are needed. The philosopher in you needs the non-dual truth. The human in you needs the beloved. Jesus lived in this same tension. I and the Father are one. That is Advaita, pure non-duality, no separation between the human Jesus and the divine Father. But he also prayed to the Father. In Gethsemane, in agony, he said, Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Yet not my will, but yours be done. That is bhakti. That is devotion. That is a self-offering itself to something greater. The greatest spiritual teachers don't resolve this paradox. They live it. They hold both ends. They know that they are Brahman, and they weep before God. They know there is no separation, and they fall in love with the divine anyway. Then comes this remarkable verse about the fire of digestion. Aham Vaishvanaro Bhutva Praninan Dehamashrita Prana Pana Samayukta Pachamya Nani Chaturvidham. I am the fire of digestion in the bodies of all living beings. United with the incoming and outgoing breath, I digest the four kinds of food. This is Krishna speaking again, Gita 15:14. And what he's saying is, the fire in your belly, the literal biological heat that breaks down your food, is God. Not metaphorically, not poetically, the actual digestive fire, the enzymes, the acid, the metabolic heat, that is divine intelligence expressing itself through your body. This is where the spiritual and the scientific completely converge. Modern biology tells us that digestion is a staggeringly complex process involving hundreds of enzymes, billions of microorganisms, electrical signals, hormonal cascades, and thermodynamic reactions that would take a team of Nobel laureates to fully describe. And 3,000 years ago, the Gita says, yes, that complexity, that intelligence, is not random. It is divine. It is Krishna. And then the section closes with one of the most beautiful prayers in all of Sanskrit literature. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Punaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavatitmastu, Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. May we be protected together. May we be nourished together. May we work together with great energy. May our study be brilliant. May we not hate each other. Om, peace, peace, peace. This is from the Taittiriya Upanishad, and it's traditionally chanted between a teacher and student. But when placed in the context of a meal prayer, it transforms the act of eating into an act of communion. May we be nourished together. Not may I be nourished, we, together. The prayer shatters the illusion that eating is a private act. You are being nourished by the sun, by the rain, by the earth, by the farmer, by the cook, by every organism in the food chain that made your meal possible. Eating is the most communal act a human being performs, even when you eat alone. May we not hate each other. This line, placed at the end of a meal prayer, is quietly devastating. Because the truth is, most of the hatred in the world comes from people who have forgotten that they share the same food, the same air, the same earth, the same source. The prayer says, when you eat, remember that everyone eats. When you are nourished, remember that everyone needs nourishment. And from that remembrance, let hatred become impossible. Jesus washed his disciples' feet. The Buddha begged for food from village to village, eating whatever was placed in his bowl without preference. Marcus Aurelius wrote, accept the things to which fate binds you, and love the people with whom fate brings you together. These are not identical teachings. but they share a common root: the recognition that we are nourished by each other, sustained by each other, and therefore obligated, not by guilt, but by truth, to care for each other. And then, Om Shanti Shanti Shanti, peace, 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 said three times, once for the physical body, once for the mind, once for the spirit. Or, peace from Atibhautika suffering, caused by other beings, from Atidaivika suffering, caused by nature or fate, and from Atyatmika suffering, caused by oneself. Three planes of peace, every plane covered, nothing left to disturb you. This is what you say before you eat your rice and dal. Segment 4, The Night, Prayers Before Sleeping, approximate runtime, 14 minutes. The day is ending. The sun has set. The work is done, or at least paused, and the tradition gives you a final set of prayers, a way to close the circle, to complete the sacred architecture of the day. The first verse, Krushnaya Vasudevaya, Haraye Paramatmane, Pranata Klesha Nashaya, Govindaya Namo Nama, salutations to Krishna, son of Vasudeva, to Hari the Supreme Self, to the one who destroys the suffering of those who surrender, to Govinda, I bow again and again. Notice what's happening. The morning prayer began with the hands, with action, with creative power, with the day ahead. The evening prayer begins with surrender. Pranata Klesha Nashaya, the one who destroys the suffering of those who bow down. The word pranata means one who has bowed, one who has surrendered, and klesha, suffering, affliction, is the same word used in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras and in Buddhist psychology. The kleshas are the root afflictions: ignorance, egoism, attachment, aversion, and the fear of death. These are the deep drivers of human suffering, and the prayer says, Krishna destroys them. But not for everyone. For pranata, for those who have surrendered. This is the great insight of the evening. You cannot muscle your way out of suffering. The kleshas are not problems to be solved through effort alone. They require surrender. They require the admission that you, the ego, the strategist, the one who has been managing and controlling and efforting all day, you cannot fix this. Something larger must take over. Every wisdom tradition knows this. In Christianity, it's called grace. You cannot earn it. You can only receive it. Paul writes, "For by grace you have been saved, through faith, and this is not from yourselves, it is the gift of God." The evening prayer is an act of receiving. All day you have been giving, doing, acting. Now you receive. Now you open your hands and let grace in. In Buddhism, there's a beautiful paradox. The Buddha taught self-reliance, be a lamp unto yourself, and yet the practice of meditation is at its deepest level an act of surrender. You sit, you stop doing, you let go of every strategy, every agenda, every effort to get somewhere. You surrender to what is. The Zen tradition calls this shikantaza, just sitting, nothing to attain, nothing to become, the complete surrender of the achieving self. In Stoicism, it's amor fati, love of fate. Marcus Aurelius, at the end of each day, reviewed what had happened and practiced accepting it, not just tolerating it, but loving it. Epictetus taught, don't seek for everything to happen as you wish it would, but rather wish that everything happens as it actually will. Then your life will flow well. That is surrender. That is pranata. The second prayer is a confession, not a guilt-ridden confession to a punishing God, but an honest, clear-eyed accounting. Kara charan krutam, vak kaya jam karma jam, va shravana nayana jam, va manasam va paradam, vihitam avihitam va, sarva me tatkshamasva, jaya jaya karunabve, Shri Mahadeva Shambho. Whatever wrong I have done through my hands, feet, speech, body, actions, ears, eyes, or mind, whether prescribed or not prescribed, forgive all of that. Victory, victory to you, O ocean of compassion, O great Lord Shambho. This is the evening examine, the examination of conscience, and it predates the Christian version by centuries, though the Christian tradition developed its own powerful form under St. Ignatius of Loyola. But look at the scope of this prayer. It covers everything: hands, feet, speech, body, actions, ears, eyes, mind, every possible channel through which you interact with the world. The prayer assumes that you have, in the course of a normal day, committed some aparadam, some transgression, some offense, some misalignment. And it does not ask you to specify. It does not ask you to wallow. It does not ask you to punish yourself. It says, Sarva mi tat kshamasva. Forgive all of it. All of it. Everything. Just forgive it. This is radical. Most guilt-based religious frameworks ask you to catalog your sins, feel terrible about each one, and then earn forgiveness through penance. This prayer says, I don't even need to list them. The divine knows. I offer the whole day, the good, the bad, the unconscious, the clumsy, the well-intentioned and the not-so-well-intentioned, and I ask for it all to be dissolved. And then it calls God Karuna Abde, ocean of compassion, not judge, not accountant, ocean of compassion. The image is not a deity weighing your good and bad deeds on a scale. The image is an infinite ocean of mercy, into which you pour your entire day, and it absorbs everything, without diminishing by a single drop. This is directly parallel to the Buddhist concept of Karuna, compassion, which is one of the four Brahmaviharas, the four divine abodes. In Buddhism, compassion is not a feeling you try to generate, it is a quality of reality itself. When you see clearly, compassion arises naturally. It is what awareness does when it meets suffering. And it's parallel to something Jesus taught that was genuinely shocking in his time. In the Lord's Prayer, forgive us our debts, as we also have forgiven our debtors. The radical part is the implication that divine forgiveness and human forgiveness are linked. God forgives you the way you forgive others. This evening prayer adds another dimension. You can also ask for blanket forgiveness. Not because you deserve it, but because the one you're asking is an ocean of compassion. Then comes the final prayer of the day, and it is, I think, the most intimate. Tvameva mata cha pita tvameva, tvameva bandushcha saka, tvameva, tvameva, vidya dravinam, tvameva, tvameva, sarvam mama deva deva. You alone are my mother and father. You alone are my relative and friend. You alone are my knowledge and my wealth. You are everything to me, O God of gods. This is pure bhakti, pure undiluted devotion. And there is no Advaitic intellectualizing here. No, everything is Brahman abstraction. This is a child crawling into the lap of the divine and saying, you are all I have. And I want to be very honest about why this prayer is so powerful, and why it might be difficult for those of us who lean toward the intellectual, the non-dual, the philosophical. It's powerful because it demands vulnerability. Advaita can become a hiding place. Everything is Brahman can become a way of avoiding the rawness of devotion. I am awareness can become a spiritual bypass, for I am lonely, or I am afraid, or I am afraid, or I need help. The evening prayer strips all of that away. It says, forget your philosophy for a moment. Forget your non-dual realization. When the lights go out and you are lying in the dark, who is your mother? Who is your friend? Who do you actually trust with your life? If the answer is Brahman, fine. But can you say it with the feeling of a child who trusts completely? Can you say, you are my mother, and mean it with your whole body, not just your intellect? This is what bhakti demands. It demands that the truth travel from the head to the heart, and not just to the heart, but to the belly, to the bones, to the place where you feel most alone. Jesus said, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Little children do not philosophize about non-duality. They crawl into their parents' arms and rest. That is what this prayer is. It is crawling into the arms of the divine and resting. The Stoics, interestingly, had their own version of this surrender. Cleanthes, the second head of the Stoic school, wrote a famous hymn, the Hymn to Zeus, which ends, lead me, O Zeus, and thou, O destiny, to whatever place you have assigned me. I follow willingly. And if I am unwilling, I follow still. There is tenderness hidden in stoic toughness. There is surrender hidden in the philosophy of acceptance. And so the day ends as it began, with an act of recognition. In the morning, you looked at your hands and saw the divine. In the evening, you close your eyes and feel the divine. The circle is complete. Segment 5. The architecture, bringing it all together. Approximate runtime, 12 minutes. So what has happened here? What has the Trikal Sandhya actually built over the course of a single day? Let me map it. At dawn, you woke up and established identity. Who am I? I am a being in whose hands dwell abundance, wisdom, and the divine. I am not just a body waking up. I am a field of sacred potential. Before stepping on the ground, you established relationship. What is my relationship to the world? It is one of reverence, humility, and awe. The earth is holy. The teacher is present. I walk with gratitude. Before eating, you established understanding. What is the nature of reality? Everything is Brahman. The act of offering is Brahman. The food is Brahman. I am Brahman. And from this understanding, I offer everything I do, every act, every meal, every breath, as a sacred offering. Before sleeping, you established surrender. What do I do with the day that has passed? I offer it. All of it. The successes, the failures, the conscious acts, and the unconscious ones. I pour it all into the ocean of compassion. And I rest in the recognition that the divine is my mother, my father, my friend, my everything. Identity, relationship, understanding, surrender. This is not a random collection of prayers. This is a complete spiritual curriculum compressed into 4 daily touchpoints. And here's what strikes me most deeply about it. This curriculum is identical in structure to what every great tradition teaches. The Buddha's path moves from right understanding, identity, who you truly are, beyond the ego, to right relationship with all beings, through compassion and ethical conduct, to right practice, understanding the nature of reality through meditation, to right liberation, the surrender of clinging, the letting go into nirvana. Jesus's teaching moves from repent, for the kingdom is at hand, wake up, establish a new identity, to love your neighbor as yourself, right relationship, to I and the Father are one, understanding the non-dual ground, to into your hands I commend my spirit, surrender at the hour of death. The Stoics move from prosoke, attention, self-awareness, knowing your nature, identity, to oikeosis, recognizing your kinship with all beings, relationship, to physics, understanding the nature of the cosmos, understanding, to amor fati, loving acceptance of everything that happens, surrender. The Bhagavad Gita moves from Arjuna's crisis of identity on the battlefield, to Krishna establishing right relationship with the world, through Dharma, to the revelation of the cosmic form, the understanding of what reality truly is, to the final instruction, Sarva Dharman Paritaja, Mam Ekam Sharanam Vraja, abandon all dharmas and surrender to me alone. The same arc, the same 4 movements, identity, relationship, understanding, surrender. Every tradition, every teacher, every day of your life, if you follow the Trikal Sandhya. And here's the thing that I want to leave you with. The thing that makes this practice different from reading a book, or attending a lecture, or even meditating once a day. This practice is embedded in the mundane. It doesn't ask you to go to a temple. It doesn't require a guru. It doesn't require special circumstances. It asks you to wake up, step on the ground, eat your food, and go to sleep, and to do these things with full, conscious, sacred awareness. The genius of the Trikal Sandhya is that it takes the 4 most ordinary, unavoidable acts of a human day, waking, walking, eating, sleeping, and turns each one into a portal. Brother Lawrence, the 17th century Christian mystic, called this practicing the presence of God. He worked in a monastery kitchen, washing dishes, and he said, "I am as close to God among the pots and pans as I am in the chapel." The Trikal Sandhya formalizes this. It builds the chapel into the kitchen, into the bedroom, into the first step of the morning. Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Buddhist monk, taught walking meditation, the practice of making every step a prayer. He wrote, "Walk as if you are kissing the earth with your feet." That is Pada Sparshan Kshamasvame. That is asking the earth's forgiveness. Same teaching, same reverence, same practice. And so I want to end where we began, with the word Sandhya, junction, twilight, the space between. The three junctions of the day, dawn, noon, dusk, are not arbitrary. They are the moments when one state transitions into another. Sleep becomes waking. Hunger becomes satisfaction. Waking becomes sleep. These transitions are the thinnest places in ordinary experience, the moments when the veil between the mundane and the sacred is most transparent. Every tradition recognizes this. The Christian tradition has its morning prayer, its grace before meals, its evening compline. Islam has its five daily prayers: Fajr at dawn, Dhuhr at midday, Asr in the afternoon, Maghrib at sunset, Isha at night, punctuating the day with remembrance. The Jewish tradition has Shacharit, Mincha, and Maariv, morning, afternoon, and evening prayers. The Buddhist tradition begins and ends the day with meditation and chanting. The human species across every culture and every century has understood that the day needs to be punctuated with awareness. That without these touch points, consciousness drifts, the ego takes over, the dream reasserts itself, and we forget. We forget who we are, we forget where we are, we forget what this whole thing is about. The Trikal Sandhya is a technology for not forgetting. And in a world that is designed, literally, algorithmically, commercially designed, to make you forget, to capture your attention, to keep you asleep and consuming and reactive. In that world, the simple act of pausing three times a day to remember the sacred might be the most radical thing you can do. Not because it changes the world, but because it changes you. And you, awake, grounded, devoted, surrendered, you are the only change the world has ever needed. Kara Mule Saraswati, Kara Madhye Tu Govinda, Prabhate Kara Darshanam. Look at your hands. The divine is already there. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti.